show on the Big 550 KTRS. I have a friend who runs a small company, and he has a couple of employees who have expense accounts, but he has told them, don't go crazy with the expense account. I want you to treat it as if it's your own money, which I told him is horrible advice, because if you tell them it's their own money, then when they want to go out and spend it, they won't think about it. Does this cost too much for the boss? They'll just decide, is it too much for them? And sometimes they'll overspend. And he said, well, I was going to tell them that it's not their money. Treat it like it's not your money. And it's probably going to be worse that way, because people go, what do I care? It's not my money. It's the boss's money. I can spend however I want. A lot of that comes up in a book called Dollars and Cents, How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter. It's written by Dan Ariely and Jeff Chrysler. And Jeff joins me now. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me and making sure that any expense account I get in the future is abused appropriately.
Tell me a couple of ways you think we Americans misthink our money.
Well, there are tons of ways, and the baseline is that we really should think about money in terms of what we call opportunity costs, which are like all the other things we could spend money on. You know, they use that $5 latte as a classic example. I think it's a silly example, but in theory, that could be $5 towards retirement or a bunch of gum, or it could be a newspaper. That's how we're supposed to think about it in traditional economics.
Nobody is thinking about it, oh, I wish I had a newspaper, Jeff.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I like to imagine it was the 80s when newspapers still existed.
Okay? Oh, I remember those days.
Yeah. So we're supposed to think about it like that, but that's really hard, in part because you're right, newspapers don't exist. But it's just a mental challenge. So instead of doing what traditional economics say we should, we find these shortcuts, these other ways to like assess value that are easy and a knee-jerk reaction. Our book is all about the different ways. One of my favorites is about how we assess value based upon the effort we see. Like, we will pay a locksmith who fumbles around for an hour and breaks a bunch of locks and swears and sweats and takes forever to let us in our home. We'll pay that person more than if someone just walked up a locksmith and did it in a minute. Because it looks like it took a lot of effort.
Yeah.
But really, we're paying for incompetence. And we do that all the time.
That's very true. And back to the opportunity cost, I mean, a perfect example of that might be when you go out to buy a car. Do you think about, well, you know, if I bought a $15,000 car instead of a $20,000 car, I can probably save that $5,000 for my kids' college or our next vacation or whatever it is? Or do you just go, you know what, that's a better car and it's nicer and I want it and I'm going to pay it off over 4 years, so what's the difference?
Right. Well, I personally think about all the newspapers I can get for $5,000. That's just me. You're right. We don't think about all the other things that we could spend. Even if you didn't buy a car at all, you could take a couple of vacations and all these other things. At best, what we might do is think about within that same category. Like you said, we might compare a $20,000 car to a $15,000. We don't really think of that money about all the things it could be, which is what we really should do when we're making financial decisions. And that's where the challenge comes and where the mistakes come, because human nature, we don't want to think about that difficult stuff.
What did we do when we didn't have money?
We bartered. You know, back in the old days, when there probably were newspapers, we would barter services. You know, hey, I know how to, you know, cut down trees for firewood, and you can come over here and sew me a blanket. And that was a challenge. And money is actually great, because money took us out of that level and made it so we could save money. We could specialize. We could have things like wine and fancy food and art, which we couldn't have had without money.
Mm-hmm. And when we had to trade for everything, it probably made those decisions about what you wanted and what you could afford a lot more difficult, right? I mean, okay, I'll chop down that tree for you, but once that tree is chopped down, what else am I going to do for you to make more clothes for me?
Right, exactly. Well, first of all, you always had to constantly be producing something. And second of all, it's hard to really judge the value between things. Like, how many chopped trees is worth a blanket? Or, you know, a chicken dinner? How many chickens for a gallon of gas?
Yeah.
And so it was constant calculations and assessing the value of things, whereas money gave you us this, like, universal language, right? Everything translated into a monetary value, and then you could trade different items and services and save and think about all the other uses of it.
Yes, well, saving right there, that's something that doesn't exist. If you're just talking about trading skills or even trading products that you make, you can't say, you know what, I'm not going to have this right now because 3 years from now I could chop down that tree.
Right. Well, you certainly couldn't have done that in the barter economy, and we really have trouble doing that here, in particularly in America. We don't save well. I've told people I feel like we have an obesity crisis in savings, except no one knows they're fat. our savings rate is terrible, and the real challenge is, like, savings is one of the great things about money, but we don't see it. Right? We see consumption. We see spending. Your neighbor gets a bigger house, a nicer car, cooler clothes. We compete on that. Human nature is to compete. But we never talk about how much savings someone has. In fact, there's a study out there. I'm trying to track it down, but I've heard talk of this study where men in the study were more willing to admit whether or not they use Viagra than how much they save for retirement. Right? Like, what's a more embarrassing thing? Like, the how, you know, tiny your savings account is, or, you know, yeah, other issues. but we're just, it's not part of our culture to discuss those things. And our hope, our delusion with this book is that by getting the people to understand better how they think about money and their financial decisions, we can talk about it more. By talking about it more, we'll get smarter and make better decisions collectively.
Isn't the root of this because we don't start talking about money with our kids when they're very young? There's no such thing as a children's financial education. A kid doesn't have to have a personal finance class or curriculum as they're going through school. So they don't really learn some of the things that you guys write about in your book.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, there are some people that question the effectiveness of, like, financial literacy, quote unquote, teaching people to save X percent. But teaching people to understand how they think about money would help. There was a fascinating study that my co-author, I believe, was involved in. I think it was in Oklahoma, where they took families and they randomly gave some families $500 or maybe it was only $50, but they gave them, like, a college savings fund when they had a newborn child. And just they got the college savings fund and they got, like, a monthly statement. And they went back 4 years later and tested those kids. And those kids that had it compared to the control group that didn't had better social and cognitive skills. Now, those four-year-olds, they didn't, like, know I have a college savings account. They didn't get it. But that family started thinking about their kid's future, started thinking, oh, they might go to college. And so they started doing things like reading to them and just creating an environment that worked better.
Wow.
And that's the type of thing that we think people can do with these money failings is, you know, not try to change human nature. We're not suddenly going to start thinking opportunity costs and thinking smarter things, but to take advantage of our human failings instead of having us be taken advantage of.
All right. Let me ask you about a couple of other phrases that come up in the book quite often. Sure. One of them is the pain of paying. What is that?
That is the fact that when we pay for something, when we hand over, like, a $20 bill, it stimulates the same region of our brain as physical pain. And that is a fascinating thing to see how it manifests itself in our financial decisions, because, you know, pain should tell us to pay attention, right? We put our hand on a stove, that ouch feeling tells us to move our hand.
Yeah.
But a lot of modern technology is actually designed to numb the pain of paying, right? Like, credit cards make it so you don't really pay attention, right? When you take out your credit card after a meal, you don't pay. You can just sign, like, a promise to pay. And then when your bill comes a month later, it's got all these other figures, so you don't think about it. And there are studies showing that we pay more and tip more with credit cards. Think about things like Apple Pay and, Easy Pass or whatever the toll system is that you have in St. Louis. All these, like, electronic things that are designed to make paying easier, quote unquote, easier. That may be true, but doesn't necessarily make it smarter or wiser, because we don't feel that pain. And when we don't feel the pain, we're not aware of the paying, and therefore we don't stop to think, should we make this decision? We don't stop about and think about the opportunity cost.
I'm happy to say we are pain-free when it comes to tolls, because we have none.
Oh, the show me say to show me how fast you can drive on the highway.
Without having to stop and pay $8 to go across a body of water like the Mississippi. We don't have that. So that's nice. No, but I understand what you're saying about Apple Pay or anything else. You don't actually have the money in your hand. So you don't have that moment where you go, okay, wait a second. Here's $40 for what I just ate. Was that really worth it? You just sign a piece of paper, or in some cases, you don't even sign a piece of paper. You just give them the piece of plastic, they give it back to you, and you're done. And you don't have any memory of what you actually gave for what you just consumed.
Absolutely. I mean, people, the studies, and we try to base this all on studies and different things, is that people just don't remember what they pay with a credit card. And it's magic, and they sort of maybe sense it for a second.
What is anchoring?
Anchoring is the idea that we will, the first price we see for an item sort of has a disproportionate pull on us. Like if you go to a car dealership, again, we're using, you see the manufacturer suggested retail price is $30,000. In our mind, we sort of think of that as what the price is, and maybe we can move a little bit farther away, but that becomes the anchor for our assessment of what that price is. This is a really powerful concept because it affects all of us, maybe to different degrees, but in many different situations. And oftentimes, we sort of we do what we call self-herding, which essentially is that we anchor our own decisions based upon our past decisions, like that $5 latte. At one point, we say, hey, that's a good decision. And then our next time we go, we think, oh, I decided $5 was a good price before, and that seems right. And on and on and on it goes. So anchoring becomes very powerful, especially when you go to places that flash sort of a suggested price or normal price, that is what we sort of then associate with that item.
One of the facts that you footnote in the book, and I love this one, is that if you go to a restaurant and they have, let's say it's a pretty good restaurant, whatever is the top priced item is never the best selling item. The best selling item is always the second highest priced item. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about? People look at that top one and go, that's too much. If I can get it for cheaper. Oh, yeah, look, here's a cheaper one. I'll get that instead.
Yeah, pretty much. It works sort of hand in hand with another concept called relativity, which is just the comparative, that looks like a better deal. But it's the same idea. And I wish I could remember the name of the man who did the study about the restaurant menus. But it is, and I do this myself, even though I know better. I've written a book about it. You go and you see something and you're like, that's a ridiculous amount. I'm going to get something just a little bit better and I'll show them. And you still end up, buying exactly what they wanted you to buy.
Yeah, they're showing you, but you didn't know it.
Exactly.
There's also a concept that I'm curious about how businesses can get us to pay more for the same item just by changing the language in how they describe that item.
Sure. That is, I think we've probably all seen this, not just in spending decisions, but in any decision that people's language can really inflate the value or make it something seem really special. Like you go to a fancy restaurant, they describe, where the beef came from and how the cow was treated and all the effort that it took to fly the cow across country and the meat to be braised with a certain blood. All this long thing. It's really just a hamburger, but they give you a 10-minute description. You're like, oh, that's really fancy.
Yeah.
Wine is a particular industry that like uses fancy language, like the tannins and I don't even know the term, the deliciousness. That's not a wine term, but the way they describe wine is so full of flowery language, and none of us, we know what tastes good, but no one really gets all the language of wine. But the fancier the language, the more we'll pay.
I think that might be the most presumptuous industry there is, because if you're a wine snob, that doesn't necessarily mean you know more about wine than other people. It means you know the language of wine more than other people. You've learned some of these things about how, you sniff it and roll it around in the glass and taste it and make that squishy sound in with the wine in your mouth and all that sort of stuff. And you seem like you're much more informed about it. But what you're really telling the world is, I'm willing to pay a lot more for the same liquid you are.
Yeah. And you know what? If that same liquid were put in a paper cup instead of in a fancy wine glass, we would pay more for the fancy wine glass, even though it's the same thing. But
if you
have the resources, I'm willing to run experiments on just drinking a bunch of wine to see what happens. So let me know after the show.
If I brought two bottles in and one had a screw cap and one had a cork in it, could you tell the difference, do you think?
I'm willing to find out. But no, if it was the same wine, I would venture that most people would actually, if they saw the screw versus the cork, would say that the cork one is a better wine, even though it's the same thing.
Absolutely.
I was kind of like, this is sort of a side note, but I remember the Pepsi challenge from back in, the 80s when it was the blind taste test.
Yeah.
I'm sure those things tasted the same. No one ever guessed Pepsi versus Coke. Come on.
They claim otherwise.
I know.
Let me go with another concept in the book. It's a bad idea to be your own realtor. If you're going to sell your house, you might think you're going to make yourself a better deal, but you're not. Why?
Right. That's because we
overvalue the things that we own. Once we have a connection to something, that emotional connection is sort of infused into the financial value we put on it. And a quick side note, like all of these things about the money stream is because emotion really does play a part in our financial assessment, whether that's confusion or love or fear of loss. And in this case, it's the emotion connected to something that we own, like a home, right? When you have a home, you look around, you're like, oh, that's where little Timmy, you know, tripped and bonked his head. And over there is where Sarah had her first steps. And you think about all the memories that are part of this home and like how valuable it is to you. But the people that are coming into the home, they have no idea about that.
Yeah, they don't right? care they, about they the don't... marks in your closet where you checked how tall Jack was every 8 months.
Right. In fact, that's a negative to them. Like, oh, we got to paint over this. And so we end
paint
up
over it. That's my son.
Higher. And it's not just a case of like, oh, you want to sell high, buy low. It's actually that when like objectively asked, we will value things we own more than those. In fact, there was another fascinating study, literally like holding a mug in your hand would make you want to sell it for more than if you hadn't touched it at all. Just that physical and emotional contact.
Interesting. So when it comes to selling a house, how am I going to save money if I were to get somebody else to do it? Are you just telling me they're going to be more realistic about the pricing of the house and that will make it more likely to sell faster?
I don't want to venture too far down the road in real estate. I live in the New York City area where, for the price of a one-bedroom apartment here, I could probably get a few houses out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, real estate has also this conflicts of interest because an agent that's getting, 6%, they want to sell it quickly, whereas you have other motivations. But if you were to put it in a vacuum, outside of those sort of conflicts of interest, then yes, the idea is someone that can more objectively assess the value is going to do a better job of understanding how to price it.
Gotcha. At the beginning of our conversation here, Jeff, you talked about how America is really bad at handling money, where we're different in that way than other countries. Which countries are good at it?
Well, the countries that are successful, it's not that they as people are different than us at all. Like human nature is the same across all cultures. But what they've done is they've created systems to take advantage of human nature. I think I used that phrase before, to look at our money failings, the way we make poor decisions, and use that to our advantage. For instance, in Australia, all jobs, you have a salary offer, and then they automatically add 9% as a retirement savings. Every job that's a salary has a 9% retirement savings, no choice. Whereas in America, we have different systems. Sometimes you can opt in, sometimes you have to save it yourself. So that makes them better savers because they've culturally decided it's important to us that we don't have, a whole population of 70-year-olds that don't have any money, so we're going to make everyone save money. And, no one complains about that. They're quite happy. That's been their choice, and we have a different system that values things differently.
Well, that's because in America, our different system is, hey, don't tell me what to do. It's my money.
Yes, that is very much a part of it. You can make an argument that we're also a particularly short-sighted, short-term viewed country, and we don't think about the future. But I would argue with myself and say, no humans really think about their long-term future very well. That's why we have to create these systems, these automatic retirement savings and things like that, because left to our own devices, we would much rather spend money on something we could play with right now than to save that money for us 30 years later when we're retired.
Right. There's a great story you have in the book about a guy who plans on working until he's 80, even though the life expectancy in this country is 78.
He'll work as fertilizer the last couple of years, I guess.
There you go. The book is called Dollars and Cents, How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter. Written by this gentleman right here, Jeff Kreisler, and Dan Ariely, who's a great studier of human nature at Duke University. Jeff, it's a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, too, and I encourage everyone to check out the book and check out peoplescience.com, which we're going to talk a lot more about this type of stuff in the months to come.
Peoplescience.com. I will put a link to it on my website, harrisonline.com. This is the Big 550 KTRS.